This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. And we start our day with Professor Samuel Friedman of Columbia University, also a columnist for the New York Times. His latest book is Jew versus Jew, The Struggle for the Soul of American Jewry. And good morning to you, Dr. Friedman.
Good morning, Jim. I'm sorry, just in the interest of no false modesty, I retired from my New York Times column in 2016, and Jew versus Jew is a couple of books ago for me.
All right, okay. Thanks for setting the record straight, and it is pertinent now. The Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, is in the Middle East today. In fact, he is in Jerusalem, as reported earlier today, meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu. He is there to try to make sure that there isn't an outbreak of more violence. There is a ceasefire right now, although one that would appear to be less than strong between Israel and the Palestinians. So let's start there. What about the latest dust-up that involved some carnage and, of course, lots of buildings falling and bombs on both sides? What's your assessment of what precipitated that and whether it is a true ceasefire?
Well, it's a ceasefire until someone breaks it, and there's a history of Israel and Hamas fighting these short-term wars with a great deal of destruction in Gaza and a great deal of fear from incoming rockets in Israel. And after anywhere from 2 weeks to 6 or 7 weeks, the ceasefire takes place and holds more or less for a few years. I think the question a lot of observers have now is what's gained by just repeating this pattern endlessly? And is there any kind of way to break this pattern? Because while it probably has short-term gains for Prime Minister Netanyahu's ability to stay in power and short-term gains for Hamas presenting itself as the leading force in the Palestinian national movement, for civilians on both sides, it's been a losing experience. And the idea that it can be repeated every couple of years without an even worse outcome, I think, is disturbing. There's been a lot of commentary from, observers who absolutely and correctly defend Israel or espouse Israel's right to defend itself, just saying that the fact that Hamas was able to have so many thousands of rockets and such longer range rockets than they'd had before just within a couple of years since the last war suggests that this idea that it's being set back in any ongoing basis by these short wars, that doesn't hold water. And the open question, certainly in my mind, is if there's another war of this sort in another 3 or 4 years, how much more sophisticated are Hamas's rockets going to be at that point?
All right. 877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. Those are the ways to contact our show. And for the moment, Samuel Friedman, professor at Columbia, who wrote a book a few years ago called Jew versus Jew, which is relevant because you were stating that here in the United States, where as many Jews live as those in Israel, there is division among Jews as far as how the conflict with the Palestinians is being addressed. How steep is that division?
It's a very steep division, Jim. In fact, just purely by coincidence, a major study by the Pew Research Center of American Jewry, which was conducted over the past year, year and a half, was released almost simultaneous with the start of the latest Gaza war. And what it showed is that a rising number of American Jews is up to about 23% now actually are saying that the United States is too supportive of Israel in the conflict with the Palestinians. So that's a real sea change. That number has gone up, I think, almost doubled since a survey was done, I believe, in 2013 that asked the same question. And among young Jews, there's a real straining towards extremes because on the one hand, among younger Jews, meaning I think roughly the 18 to 29-year-old demographic, there's a higher percentage who are Orthodox than in older demographics. That's mostly because of birth rate. And Orthodox Jews tend to be the most politically conservative and the most highly attached to Israel, and particularly to the Netanyahu government. And at the same time, in that 18 to 29-year-old demographic, there's a growing number of Jews who don't identify religiously at all, who identify whether Jewishness as a kind of peoplehood or ethnicity, not religiously, and they tend to be the most liberal, progressive, whatever term you want to put on it, on the Israel-Palestine issue, even to the point of about, I think, 13% of that young group coming out in favor of the boycott, the divestment, and sanctions movement. So you're looking at this cohort of young American Jews who are going to, obviously, in coming decades, be moving into, you know, more prominence, leadership positions in all facets of both Jewish life and more broadly American life, and you have the starkest divide possible there. The strongest opinions on either extreme are the opinions that are growing, and that's very different from what you see if you look in this study at opinion and, you know, 65 and up, or 50 to 64, or almost any of the older age groups.
Now, yesterday at the Baton Rouge Press Club, a respected pollster, Ron Fauché, said the American public, this is everybody, has only a 30% approval rate for President Biden's handling of this Middle East crisis involving Israel and the Palestinians. Yet most Democrats, or most Jews in the United States, vote Democratic. Why do you think that is the case?
Well, those are two questions. I think the approval rate, Ron is a great pollster. I know his work very well, and I don't know the details of what the survey showed, but it seems to me it's not surprising that you would have Biden being criticized probably from both sides, and in fact, in a way, from three sides, which might leave 30% approval. Number one, you have people in the Republican Party who and political conservatives who wanted him to be all in with supporting Israel, probably not pushing for a ceasefire, you know, maybe pushing through more American arms. Then you have people on the progressive end of the spectrum upset with him that they feel that he wasn't outspoken enough against Israel's bombings of Gaza and the civilian killing that resulted from that. And then you have people in the political center who are just saying you should have gotten involved sooner, who agree with the idea of working towards a ceasefire as a short-term answer, but want him to be more engaged with trying to restart the peace process ongoing. So if you chip away from 100% with those three groups, all of which have beef with President Biden, that might leave you with 30%. In terms of why American Jews vote heavily Democratic and have for, you know, a century, really, it really goes back to Al Smith's campaign in 1928 and hasn't changed much since then, is because on a whole range of issues, the Democratic Party tends to be in sync with where American Jewish voters are. You know, it's everything from, if you go back to New Deal and Great Society economic programs, to in the present day immigration reform, gay marriage, abortion rights. There are a whole slew of domestic issues on which American Jews are in sync with the Democratic Party. And although, and also fewer American Jews, and I think a lot of voters realize, are one-issue voters on Israel. Israel, you know, will chart in a lot of surveys as maybe the fourth or fifth issue of consequence for American Jews. It's not number one.
All right. 877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. We do have some questions for Professor Friedman from listeners, and one of them involves President Trump, who he certainly prided himself on being a, quote, defender of Israel. He was a proponent of moving the embassy to Jerusalem, and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, just a few weeks ago was talking about how the Middle East conflict was basically solved and that he had done it. Well, we found out otherwise. But what's your take on President Trump's handling of Israel and the Middle East?
I'm highly critical of it. I think that, you know, the Abraham Accords are a welcome change, but I think, unfortunately, they contributed to a false complacency that the Palestinian issue is going to somehow magically disappear. And Jews of all people should understand that national movements and the desire to return to homeland doesn't go away. It may wax and wane during periods of time, but it never vanishes. And that's also another reason I'm critical with some of President Trump's moves. I'm not against at all the idea of moving the embassy to Jerusalem, but to ask nothing in return, I think, is a misuse of political capital.
Back after this. 877-217-5757 is your Talk Louisiana number. We're back with Professor Samuel Friedman of Columbia University, the author of Jew versus Jew, and the Middle East has been, at least thus far, the seminal point in the world for President Joe Biden in his early days. And, of course, his popularity level is at 54% overall, but only 30% approval rating for his handling of the conflict between the Palestinians and Israel. Again, 877-217-5757 for Samuel Friedman. And a listener, this is Hal in Monroe, asks about President Trump and even Benjamin Netanyahu courting evangelical Christians as part of the coalition for their point of view. Is this something that is relevant in this discussion?
Hal, that's a very, very astute observation. And I think one of the misapprehensions that a lot of people have about Donald Trump's moves on Middle East policy is that they're aimed at trying to flip Jewish votes. That was a very secondary consideration. The main consideration was appealing to his base of evangelical Christian voters. And you have to understand all of his moves and Prime Minister Netanyahu's political moves, I don't mean military moves, in light of appealing to evangelicals. The former Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Ron Dermer, just about a week or week and a half ago, was being interviewed by an Israeli newspaper and basically said the quiet part out loud. He said, you know, Israel's passionate supporters in the U.S. are evangelicals, and they're much larger in number than American Jews, and American Jews are overrepresented among Israel's critics, so we should really be spending our political efforts appealing to evangelical voters and pretty much forget about American Jews, except for the Orthodox.
Randy and Zachary. Randy, you're on with Professor Friedman.
Professor, I just happened to realize something, that it was 73 years ago that Israel declared its independence, so I find it interesting that it's happened this month.
All right, well, go ahead.
The fighting, I think, you know, you're right about the importance of some calendar dates, but not particularly Israeli Independence Day, but a couple of the dates that very much factored into the outbreak of violence this year are the fact that it was, first of all, the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, which, because it's on a lunar calendar, moves around on our civil calendar. It happened to fall this year during April and May, and some of the conflict between Israeli police and Palestinian worshipers at the Temple Mount was happening right during Ramadan, which raised tensions incredibly and helped give Hamas a pretext, of a cynical pretext for starting to fire rockets. And the other date that matters a lot is what's called in Hebrew Yom Yerushalayim, Jerusalem Day, and it's the Israeli holiday that celebrates the conquering of the West Bank and, most importantly, the reunification of Jerusalem during the Six-Day War in 1967. So that's also a day of great joy for Israelis and great tensions with Palestinians because of what happened. And the third calendar date that comes in is, from the Israeli standpoint, it's Independence Day. From the Palestinian standpoint, it's what they call the Nakba, the great catastrophe, the either voluntary or involuntary movement of about 700,000 Palestinians out of what became Israel during the 48 war.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on with Dr. Friedman. Good morning to you, Dan.
Good morning. Yeah, Dr. Friedman, do you make a distinction between the Jewish religion and Jews as an ethnic group?
All right. Well,
I don't make a distinction. I think some people in polling are asked that question, is how do you identify? A typical polling question is, do you identify as Orthodox, conservative, not in the political term, but as a religious denomination, conservative, reform, or do you identify as unaffiliated? And unaffiliated means that your sense of being Jewish isn't rooted in Jewish worship or, you know, synagogue membership. It's rooted in, you know, this kind of vaguer sense of peoplehood or ethnicity.
Today's New York Times front page, a story about Israel, saying Israel no longer needs American security guarantees to protect it from neighboring states, with which it has mostly made peace, nor does it see itself as needing American mediation in the Palestinian conflict, which Israelis largely find bearable and support maintaining as it is. Do you think that's an accurate assessment?
I read that story actually online last night. I think it overstates its premise. I think Israel has become less dependent in certain ways on the U.S., and there's some, you know, financial data in that article is very useful, what percentage of the Israeli budget American aid now makes up. But in terms of being the biggest worldwide ally of consequence to Israel, the United States will absolutely continue to matter. And believe me, there'd be incredible anxiety within Israel if there was a sense that support was being lost there. In fact, there's a lot of anxiety right now about the fact that Israel is looking much less like a bipartisan cause here than it traditionally has been. So I'm not completely in agreement with the conclusion that story comes to.
Bill Huey writes, we're witnessing the last vestiges of what has been known as the Arab-Israeli conflict. That quote is from one Jared Kushner, advisor to President Trump and son-in-law, husband to Ivanka Trump. He crowed in the Wall Street Journal on May 25th, 2021. Bill writes or asks, does this mean that Jared Kushner's peace plan has failed?
Jared Kushner's peace plan is a partial success because Israel has relations now with four Arab states that didn't have them with beforehand, and I think the most significant actually is Morocco, because there's a huge Moroccan Israeli population that I think is overjoyed to have relations with its original homeland of Morocco. But the peace plan is a total failure, with the idea that you could bring a lasting peace while just circumventing any settlement with the Palestinians. That's been shown in very short order to be a completely baseless idea.
And another listener who knows a bit about you, this is Tom on Bluebonnet, says, is this the same guy who wrote the book about black college football?
Yes, it is, and happy to be back. Thank you, Tom, for remembering that book, Breaking the Line. When someone said they were calling in from Zachary before, I was going to say Doug Williams' hometown.
That is correct. You know a bit about Grambling and Southern and the other SWAC schools.
Yep, in Monroe, you'd call her Monroe. That's where James Shaq Harris is from. So I've done my time in Louisiana for sure and enjoyed it.
And your book, if I recall correctly, was about the important year of 2013. Why was that so relevant?
Well, it came out in 2013, but it was Breaking the Line was set in 1967, which was a really important year in civil rights history, and also was a year on the field in which what I think were the two greatest HBCU football programs, Grambling, of course, and Florida A&M, ended up playing in this game called the Orange Blossom Classic, which was basically the Super Bowl of black college football at that time. And, you know, it was a year when James Harris really broke through as a starting quarterback, paving the way for him to become the first regular starting black quarterback in the NFL.
Donna in Mid-City. Donna, you're on with Professor Friedman. Hi, Donna.
Hi. Can you give a quick explanation on why Jewish people are hated so much? I hate to show my ignorance,
well,
but I would appreciate an answer.
To that, I don't mean to laugh at it. It's a grim question, and there are all sorts of different pieces of it. You know, there is hatred based in religion, having a different religion. There's hatred based in the ideas, these contradictory ideas, hatred based in the idea that Jews are revolutionary, hatred based in the idea that Jews are capitalists who are controlling the economy. So it's a whole complicated hairball of mutually irreconcilable attitudes about Jews.
We do have to roll, but thank you, Dr. Friedman. Jew versus Jew is the book. We'll return after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number, and in studio is young environmental activist Allison Wolverton. She is the lead organizer for Save Our Water, and she is a graduate of St. Joseph Academy here in Baton Rouge, Tulane, wearing her Tulane green today, and a student in environmental policy in grad school at George Washington University. And she is monitoring what's going on with Senate Bill 203. Bodie White is the sponsor, and it involves the titans of industry in our community, many of them, and the Baton Rouge aquifer. General Russell Honoré was on this show not so long ago, put it succinctly, saying Senate Bill 203 is a bad bill and deserves to be defeated. Well, right now it's on its way to going to the governor's desk unless something changes. Where is it in the process, Allison?
Well, actually, just yesterday afternoon, it was on the House floor where it was read for the second time. So we're expecting it to be read a third time and then be voted on sometime later this week or next week.
Okay, so it's close to the finish line. It's already cleared the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And Bodie White, as we know, has some mojo in the Senate. And it involves, as I said, many names that we're familiar with in the world of industry and their inclusion in basically having control over the Baton Rouge aquifer. Can you give us the version of what exactly would happen if the bill passes?
Absolutely. Well, a little bit of background on this bill. The Capital Area Groundwater Conservation Commission is the primary management entity for the Southern Hills Aquifer, which is a fresh groundwater reserve where Baton Rouge citizens draw 100% of our drinking water, and it provides a lot of the drinking water to households in the surrounding parishes. So it's a really important resource, especially for household users, for agriculture, farm, and also industry. Right.
And an 18-member volunteer panel regulates the aquifer. And Bodie White would allow industrial companies to nominate employees to the Capital Area Groundwater Conservation Commission. Now, some people believe this is a huge conflict of interest. I suspect you share that view.
Right. And when it came up in Senate committee a couple of weeks ago, the representative from the Louisiana Ethics Board explained pretty clearly and succinctly that this is a public-private conflict of interest, right? If you have someone who's working for Exxon or Entergy, for example, sitting on a board that's primarily focused to regulate the amount of water, the daily quantities that Exxon, Entergy, Georgia-Pacific is drawing from the reserve, it puts those individuals in a very compromised position. For example, if it came up to the board, okay, well, let's levy a fee or let's limit pumping quantities. Are they going to be able to say yes if they're also employed by those companies? So the fact that this bill had to come up in, you know, as a piece of legislation to undo the ethics charges suggests that, you know, maybe those ethics charges really did have standing.
And the bill actually even applies retroactively, doesn't it?
It does, and it works backwards. These ethics charges were filed nearly a year ago, I believe. And so it says, okay, well, let's work backwards and remove them.
And the bill passed unanimously in its first legislative obstacle, the Senate and Governmental Affairs Committee. I mean, it was supported by industrial companies, Exxon, Entergy, and Coke. And Bodie White is a retired employee of Exxon. And It's headed to the full Senate, still has, or excuse me, it's headed to the full House now. It's already been approved by the Senate and by a House committee, and Governor John Bel Edwards is, of course, capable of vetoing it if it gets to his desk, because he weighed in.
He hasn't said anything specific yet, but we are hoping for that veto.
If it gets there, do you think it's going to be hard to stop in the House, or is there momentum to keep it from getting to the governor?
We would like to see some momentum in the House, but given the way it went in the Senate and in the House committee, it looks like it will probably pass right on through.
As we know, industry has a lot of clout at the Capitol.
Absolutely.
But industrial companies, as we know, pump water from the aquifer. They'd like to continue that practice. Environmental advocates for years have tried to push them off and make them pump water from the Mississippi River, arguing they are exacerbating saltwater intrusion that could threaten our drinking supply. Kathy Wascom of the Louisiana Environmental Action Network says the bill is an ethics carve-out that benefits industry. She goes on, our drinking water is so vital to everything we do. Of course, I think that's evident, but why has the bill not gotten more pushback among legislators?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons for that. Part of it is that people don't always know really what it's about. It sounds complicated. People don't know about our drinking water, and that's one thing that this campaign has really been focusing on, taking drinking water from a political issue to a household conversation. But, you know, there's a lot of political interests in the state that continually favor industry, and it takes a lot of people power to push back against that.
Okay, well, Tracy at the Capitol writes that the proponents of the bill say that the industry would still have a distinct minority on this commission, and it might not be such a big deal. That's what the proponents say. Why would that be a factor if some members got on who were minority members but were perhaps employed by Exxon or Georgia Pacific or Entergy? Why would that be a huge issue with you?
Sure, and I think the issue really lies in looking at the history of the Groundwater Commission. It was established in 1974, and since then, you know, in 1974, we knew that saltwater intrusion was an issue, and not much has been done, hardly anything, until just the past few weeks, actually. So a big reason for this is that the members on the commission who were representing industry were in positions of leadership, and it just shows that though there might have been a minority in terms of number, in terms of leadership and the way they shaped the commission's plan, they were not a minority.
Bodie White, as we know, ran second in the mayoral race in 2016. He got 48% of the votes in losing to Sharon Weston Broome, and he's involved in various measures that are inflaming some, and others, of course, are cheering him on, but he's also involved in the Breck bill, which is yet to be resolved. And he's diving into some sensitive territory and appears to be doing this with impunity. Bodie White is not afraid to put his views out on the line, is he?
No, he's not, but I think probably a lot of people are afraid to oppose him, you know, chair of finance committee, so that might be part of the resistance to vote in opposition. It's always hard to say, but between the Breck bill and this water bill, there is a lot of movement out there.
Reverend Vanderweel calling from Southside. Good morning. You're on with Allison Wolverton of Save Our Water. Hi, Reverend.
Good morning. Allison, I heard you mention other parishes being involved. How many parishes in Louisiana draw water from the Southern Hills Aquifer? And how many people's tap water is going to be affected by saltwater intrusion, should that be happening?
Thank you, Reverend Vanderweel, for this question. I think that when looking at Senate Bill 203 and its impact on the commission, it's really important to say, why does this commission matter? Why does our water matter? And that's because the Southern Hills Aquifer provides the drinking water supply, not just for East Baton Rouge Parish, but West Baton Rouge Parish, East and West Feliciana, Pointe Coupe, Points of Ascension Parish. It's part of a much larger groundwater system that's vital to the economy and the public health of our state. So I believe it's about, you know, 450,000 households in East Baton Rouge Parish alone, plus this entire region.
877-217-5757. Susan and Tara. Susan, you're on with Allison Wolverton.
Does the Baton Rouge Water Company, which is a private company, if I'm correct, have any long-term plan to make sure saltwater intrusion doesn't ruin our fresh groundwater supply?
The Baton Rouge Water Company, it's very interesting that you bring that up. Thank you. They also sit on the Groundwater Commission, and they do have a very important stake in this issue. So they're a public company, provide the municipal tap water to every household in the city. But no, they don't at the moment have a long-term plan to ensure that this water is used sustainably.
The tax breaks that Exxon gets and Georgia Pacific, those are substantial, aren't they, already?
They are. They do get substantial tax breaks under the ITAP, Industrial Tax Exemption Program.
Yeah, yeah, significant. And that means they don't have to pay anything for the water they're getting from the aquifer. Lady at the Capitol. Lady, you're on with Allison Wolverton.
Allison, this is Lady Carlson. Shouldn't we be calling our legislators in the House urging them not to vote for this bill?
Absolutely. That's something that you and I and all of the citizens of Baton Rouge can do. Call your legislators and tell them to vote against Senate Bill 203.
And lawmakers still respond to that sort of thing. 877-217-5757 for Allison Wolverton. Save Our Water. She's with us for a little bit longer. Jonathan in Wimbledon Estates. Jonathan, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Jim. So my question for Allison has to do with the issue of river water for industry versus pristine potable water from the aquifer. I've lived in a number of different cities. I know that, for instance, even in New Orleans, industry uses river water that it obviously has to treat for its industrial process input water. My question is, why shouldn't industry be using water from the Mississippi River in Baton Rouge instead of pristine potable water from the Southern Hills aquifer?
Right. Well, industry, of course, has a financial incentive to use water from the aquifer because it's so fresh. There's almost no treatment required in order to use it for industry or for drinking. But the same goes for our household tap water. When we pull from that aquifer, it's so fresh. Whereas if we were to draw from the Mississippi River, it's extremely costly to treat, and the treatment processes are not always perfect. We look at New Orleans or other cities around the state, and they have boil water advisories, you know, several times a year. Here in Baton Rouge, our water is perfect. It's never a problem, and it's something that the citizens of Baton Rouge take a lot of pride in. So the question is, why would we, you know, willingly destroy this resource that we have and instead have to switch to the Mississippi River?
Allison Wolverton will be with us for a few more moments, and we're scheduled to hear from Oscar Schoenfeld, sports agent with a captivating story, but we'll talk more with Allison. Your number 877-217-5757 back in a couple of minutes. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us. Matt Doyle producing. 877-217-5757. A few more minutes with Allison Wolverton of Save Our Water. She is battling Senate Bill 203 from Bodie White, which would allow some titans of industry to have authority over the Southern Hills Aquifer. And we've gotten some people who are lathered up about it. Pam in Oakley Hills. Pam, you're on with Allison. Hi, Pam.
Good morning. Allison, do you have any idea why the Baton Rouge Water Company does not find it an incentive for them to conserve this water? I do know they've already gone out and bought land on the Mississippi River just in case they need it.
That is a good question. And as I said a minute ago, the Baton Rouge Water Company also has seats on this commission. And, you know, the implications of Senate Bill 203 would be important for both the commission and then, you know, therefore the Baton Rouge Water Company. They're a for-profit company. So if they shift our water production to the Mississippi River, they simply pass those costs along to the users, right? And we would just be paying more for our tap water. So they know that. Everyone knows that saltwater intrusion is a real threat, and they're preparing for the long run.
Bill downtown. Bill, good morning. You're on with Allison Wolverton.
Hi. I've worked in groundwater hydrology for over 30 years, and the key issue I see is that when it runs out, it runs out. There's no way we'll ever replace it. The river is a much more renewable resource that ought to be done for consumptive uses. Save our water.
That's a great question. So groundwater actually is restored annually. Louisiana has very heavy rainfall, and that does seep into the ground through the layers of sand and clay and will very slowly regenerate the aquifer's reserves. So technically speaking, it is a renewable resource, but in terms of our management strategies and our economic thinking around it, we have to think more about it as a non-renewable resource because the rate we're pumping is so much faster than the rate that it can naturally restore. So in terms of something like industrial users that are pumping half of all the water that's withdrawn from the aquifer every year, half of that goes to household users and farms. Another half is being used by industry for their hydraulic processes, heating and cooling. And mm-hmm. so, yeah, in that sense, it very much makes more sense to switch to the Mississippi River.
On the whole, has it been a good session for environmentalists?
Not so much. Not this time around.
Why not?
Well, there have been a lot of bills that were killed in House Natural Resources, Senate Natural Resources, that we were hoping to see along further and mm-hmm. or passed that we were hoping wouldn't be. And
well, it's a case in which lawmakers obviously benefit from industry, as all of us do in one way or another. But there is a cost, as we know, and that cost is addressed by environmentalists like Allison Wolverton, who is young and is getting her graduate degree in environmental policy, and hopefully you'll come back home from George Washington University.
I hope so.
Well, thanks for staying with us today, and we look forward to a return visit very soon.
Thank you so much, Jim. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. And I'm told by producer Matt Doyle that Oscar Schoenfeld III, the sports agent of note, will not be with us today. And I talked to Oscar yesterday. He's in Durham, North Carolina. And he was awaiting a heart transplant. He'd been there for 4 weeks, so he may have gotten the word that it was his time. And Matt says he did undergo surgery, so I hope it's for the heart transplant, because he very patient to be there 4 weeks, and he went under the knife today. And he has written a book about his life and times. Many of you see his sign on Perkins Road, but he has represented many of the leading athletic lights in Louisiana professionally, and has quite a story to tell about the whole world of being a sports agent. So we wish Oscar the best, and hopefully we will have occasion to talk with him soon. Today, The Advocate, in its editorial that is from the newspaper, the headline, "A State Police Investigation Needs Facts, Truth, and Transparency," noting it's been more than 2 years since a state police trooper-involved incident and resulted in the death of barber Ronald Green in Ouachita Parish. And that subject was addressed yesterday quite well by Charles Blow, columnist for the New York Times. And he is a native Louisianian. He knows North Louisiana well, and he knows the area well where Ronald Green was killed. And I think obviously, he died as a result of the beating he took. He did engage in a high-speed chase that resulted in police stopping him, and Blow notes that that's wrong, but here's Charles Blow's assessment of what happened in North Louisiana 2 years ago. Interstate 20 in North Louisiana links so many of the places that formed me. It runs through Shreveport, where I was born, and the place where I met my ex-wife and we had our wedding. About 30 miles east, it runs along the southern edge of Minden, where my mother took us to buy clothes each year, the same city where one of my brothers now lives and where he teaches at the high school. Approximately 15 miles east of Minden, I-20 passes about a mile north of the flyspeck town where I grew up, Gibbsland. Named after an enslaver named Gibbs, much of the land had been his plantation, literally Gibbs land. 8 miles east of Gibbsland, the highway scrapes across the top of Arcadia. It was our parish seat, the place with the closest library, the place where I saw my first movie, and the place where I acquired my driver's license. 15 miles east of Arcadia, I-20 passes through the northern edge of Grambling, home to Grambling State University, where I went to college, studied mass communications, and became co-editor of the Gramblinite, the school's newspaper. About 30 miles east of Grambling, the highway bisects the city of Monroe, where my friends and I often went to parties while we were in college and where my nephew lived with his mother. All these cities and towns are majority black, writes Charles Blow, and their administration, including policing, reflect that to some degree. These spaces always felt special to me, at least in the relationship between municipal power and the people. But between those safe places along Interstate 20, the Louisiana State Police reigned. We called the officers state troopers. The feeling they gave, at least to me, was not one of safety. All this is why the killing of Ronald Green in 2019 and the recently released video from one trooper's body camera footage of the arrest, obtained by the Associated Press, that is discordant with the official police report of the incident, has been so resonant for me. It was in the city of Monroe that Green, a 49-year-old black man, encountered the troopers. Green was a barber, as is one of my brothers. According to a crash report reviewed by the Associated Press, troopers attempted to pull him over for an unspecified traffic violation, but he refused to stop, and a pursuit ensued. This is how the AP reported the conclusion of the single-page police report released by state police, which said the chase ended when Green crashed his vehicle. Green was taken into custody after resisting arrest in a struggle with troopers, the report says, adding that he became unresponsive and died on the way to a hospital. The report does not describe any of the use of force by troopers. The Louisiana State Police later claimed it was the troopers, that troopers did use force and that it was justified. The video, however, shows the troopers, all white, jolting Green with a stun gun, forcing him to the ground, putting him in a chokehold, and punching him in the face. On the video, you can hear Green saying, "I'm sorry, I'm scared." As the AP reported about the video, instead of rendering aid, the troopers will leave the heavyset man unattended, face down, and moaning for more than 9 minutes as they use sanitizer wipes to wash blood off their hands and faces. "I hope this guy ain't got expletive deleted AIDS," one of the troopers can be heard saying. After a several-minute stretch in which Green is not seen on camera, he appears again limp, unresponsive, and bleeding from his head and face. He is then loaded onto an ambulance gurney, his arm cuffed to the bed rail. Everything about this case is wrong. It is true that fleeing the police isn't smart or legal, but it's also true that doing so shouldn't be a death sentence. Furthermore, the police report, which would have been the only official accounting of Green's death if this video hadn't come to light, is a damning false accounting of events, one that is in line with other false accountings that have been refuted by video and high-profile police killings. Black people distrust the police because things like this teach black people to distrust the police. This is how, this is not paranoia, it is practicality. Others in the policing structure, no doubt, also saw this footage in the intervening 2 years since Green was killed, and no one apparently said anything. You can't argue that the cops who kill are just a few bad apples when it is the whole tree that is shading the truth. Part of the problem is a lack of diversity. As the Advocate newspaper reported, in 2018, although 32% of Louisiana's population is black, only 16% of state troopers are. On Saturday, the Advocate reported that Troop F, the Monroe-based division, has 66% members, 66 members, and only six are black. The area they patrol is about 40% African-American. The Troop F roster is 86% white, 9% black, 86% white, 9% black. The connective tissue between these majority black cities and towns that dot I-20 in northern Louisiana is being patrolled and policed by an overwhelmingly white force, unattached and unresponsive to them, concludes Charles Blow. What could possibly go wrong, he finishes. So there we are. Jacoby and Lafayette, you get the last word. Please be brief. You are on.
Yeah, I'd like to also raise attention to the case in New Iberia where a young man was handcuffed and was put into the back of the police cruiser, and somehow he managed to find a gun and shoot himself in the chest.
All right. Well, thank you, sir. The beat goes on, and we will follow it. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support on this one-year anniversary of George Floyd's killing.